Welcome back, Red Ice members. We are talking with George Haas and William Saunders from the SidoniaInstitute.com. We're talking about their books, The Sidonia Codex and The Martian Codex. We've been going through some of the basic material, primarily talking about the face on Mars and the possible, I guess, civilization behind all this. And we have much more pictures to go through as well, and many of the features that they've been studying we left out from the first hour. So let's carry on here in the next segment and talk more about, well, there's one image that came up right away here. Obviously, the third one, if we look at that, George, the hero twin that you mentioned before, of course, as the as one of these Mayan archetypes, if you will, or Olmec archetypes. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that, George.
Yeah, the profiled head there is, we think, one of the hero twins, probably, Hunahou. And you can see by looking at the head, he seems to have a shaved head. There's no hair up there. He might have these locks of hair on the side of the head. And he appears to have this, the profiled face appears to be in like a blowing suggestion with the lips puckered. We spoke earlier about the parrot, which is actually just below that. The wing formation goes up, and then there's like an expansive area of a canyon or whatever. I guess Bill could be more descriptive. And then there's this huge profiled head that appears to be looking at the parrot with his lips puckered as if he was blowing the blowgun that shot that little dart that hit the parrot in the beak. So that's basically what we're seeing here. And interestingly, faintly on his cheek, you can see this little large letter I and a letter L. This is called the ick mark on the cheek. And again, in the book, we show pictures of the Maya, the corn god, which is also Hunahou, with this tonsured head, which is a balding, shaved head. And he has the same ick, this I and L mark on his cheek. So we thought that was pretty interesting, connecting the archetype there.
Really interesting. And what are we talking about in terms of size on this thing? Bill, have you looked into how large this particular image is?
No, I haven't actually measured it, but the parrot is about 2 kilometers from the beak to the tail. And so this would probably be in that range of 2 to 3 kilometers from the top of the head to the chin, is my guess. Most of these structures that we have worked with are in the range of 0.5 kilometer to 3 kilometers in size.
Really interesting. I mean, there is similar features to faces here on Earth as well. I know a while back I stumbled over a news item which basically shows a, well, I guess it's a Native American face primarily, almost with the feathers going back as well, that's been spotted here on Earth. It's about 225 meters long and can be clearly seen on Google Earth. Do you guys think that there's similarities between these images as well? I don't know if you're aware of that particular.
Well, that American Indian you're talking about, that big profile, that's up in Canada, actually.
Oh, really? No. Okay.
Yeah, it's not very far from where I live, actually, and it appears to be made out of natural, it appears to be a natural formation made out of the hills in the area. It'd be interesting to dig those hills and just see what they're composed of.
Absolutely.
And the interesting thing about that Indian formation, like Bill saying, it was started out possibly as a natural formation that, again, was altered, just to give it that eye and the lips and everything, just to give it that overall facial feature with the feathering of the Indian headdress. In that same area, just above that Indian head, there's a Canadian Indian reservation right there.
Hmm, there we go.
So that's kind of interesting that you have an Indian camp, a reservation right there, and then, of course, an aerial view kind of looks like an Indian.
Absolutely.
Kind of strange.
And what about if we talk about the DNM pyramid? This is a very unusual structure as well. It almost, in some images to me, look almost like a human being with its arms and legs stretch out like a pentagonal shape, obviously, which is kind of rare. I don't know if there's any similar pyramid shapes here on Earth. We mostly get the four-sided ones, of course, but maybe someone would like to comment and talk a little bit about the DNM pyramid as well.
Well, early on, Richard Hoagland compared it to Leonardo da Vinci's anatomical drawing of man, you know, the five points of man, which basically shapes a pentagon. And if you do look at the inverted image of the pyramid in the Viking imagery, it does appear to have like a stick figure type form going on there.
Really interesting. And same there. I think there are correlations between the Dienen pyramid, as far as I know, is primarily in the Cydonia region. And apparently there is angles and certain mathematics, so to speak, incorporated into the whole region here. And the Dienen pyramid seems to be as a node point in this, if I've understand that correctly, if any of you want to talk about that a little bit.
Yes, Richard Hoagland had, in his book, The Monuments of Mars, he had done some research into the angles, and his starting point was the DNM, because Errol Torin, a geomorphologist as well, had done some research on DMN and DNM, and he had found that there was a number of mathematical formulas and numbers that were repeated over and over again, and then Richard Hoagland had determined that there was a redundancy in some of these numbers in angles, and as we talked earlier about the situation of some of these structures in Cydonia, where they are placed, and so that was his starting point. You're correct. There is, well, nobody that I know of has found a five-sided pyramid on Earth, three-sided and four-sided. And again, this looks like a five-sided pyramid from the Viking orbiter image from 1,000 miles up. But as you get closer, you can see that it is not, from the Mars Global Surveyor images, it is not a five-sided pyramid. And when I spent quite a bit of time studying this, and then suddenly I realized that there was a profile of a human face, human-like face, that was very effeminate looking, right in on the side, I guess it would be the west side, and this face had a headdress that looked like a canine, a wolf or a dog headdress. And as we have found that there are half images and bifurcated images, I looked for a place that I could mirror or duplicate that image. And as I was doing that, I noticed a half image of a young girl or a woman. So that is where I did the duplication. And I think that is presented to you as the moon goddess.
That's right. That's right. We have several images of that. And what determined you to this conclusion, so to speak, in terms of moon goddess? Is it more correlation here to the Mesoamerican culture?
Yes. Well, George was the one who made this connection. He had seen similar. I think it was the headdress that really struck him, because the canine or the dog has this dangling back tongue, and many of the iconographies of the moon goddess, she is appears with these dogs, and they all have this dangling tongue. And so he started doing more studying and realized there's many features on this young woman that matched the moon goddess. And then I had realized that just above this is a perfectly round crater with a crescent-shaped center to it, and it almost appears like she's pointing to it. Then, on top of that, just recently, George has found an image of a rabbit just above, and a rabbit is also, in Mesoamerican culture, is associated with the moon.
There you
Maybe
go.
You want to elaborate a little bit more, George.
Yeah, the interesting thing about this, we didn't feature the DNM pyramid in our first book, which was solely dedicated to the face on Mars and the surrounding formations. And, of course, the DNM pyramid is one of the most famous. The reason we didn't feature the DNM in the first book was because NASA had only supplied us with a little sliver in one of their newer images by the time our book came out. So we didn't have a full image of the DNM pyramid. And then to this day, we still don't have a single full image of high resolution of the DNM pyramid. If you look at the slides that we sent you, labeled D. You notice at the top there's the R06, the R07, and the R11 numbers. Those are three different images that Keith Laney and his colleague Williams, we call this the Laney and Williams D&M composite, they put the three different strips together to create this full image of the D&M pyramid. Michael Malin was the first one to what they call sew together these three images to put out on his website and to release as an image of the day of a D&M pyramid image. And however, he used three different images. For the center line, if you're looking at the image that we provide for your listeners, you can actually see the profiled, the very young face there. She's looking to the left. She appears to have her eyes closed. She has like a little button nose. Do you see that?
Yep, yep.
That whole part of her face is missing in the Malin release. He used a Themis image, which was a low resolution, which was a Themis, which is basically a heat image, which he had converted to black and white, and he stitched that in the center.
I see.
You look at his image, which we have duplicated in the book, and you can go to his website and look up the D&M pyramid where he has the three different strips, you don't see her face at all, because that strip down the center of the D&M pyramid is, like I said, from a Themis image, which is low resolution, it's very fuzzy, and you don't see anything. Mm-hmm. Now, the reason Bill was able to put this all together and see the profiled face there was because he had gone searching the web, and I guess he had stumbled onto Laney's composite here. And Bill was doing all this on his own. I didn't know anything about this until Bill put up his own private website, and he featured his study of the D&M pyramid on there. And Bill had no idea that any of this was connected to Mesoamerica or what it was. He just noticed he found this young profiled face with the dog headdress and this other. When he duplicated the center, he got this woman with her arms outstretched in a long dress and her breast exposed, and she got her eyes closed and she's looking down. And I guess that is an image F.
Yes.
Right, and when I saw it, I noticed, like Bill had mentioned, about the wolf headdress having this tongue or this large tooth in the back of the mouth. This is, again, like Bill said, right out of Mesoamerican iconography. Archaeologists argue over if this is a tongue, if this is a tooth. Some interpretations are this is actually what they call a breath scroll, which a lot of Mayan masks will have these little curly. Some people think they look like little teeth coming out of the corners of the mouth. There's a lot of debate in the archaeological world about what these are. They're not tongues, they're not teeth. They may be what they call a breath scroll, which is, deals with death. And of course, the moon goddess and the dog goes under into the underworld, so there's all this death symbolism. So the interesting thing about this, that we have this odd placement of this tooth or tongue or breath scroll in the back of the dog's headdress, which is right out of Mesoamerican mythology. So every structure that we investigate seems to all come up with all this Mesoamerican mythology. And, of course, now we have the young moon goddess and the old moon goddess, and Bill just mentioned that right above the D&M pyramid we have this crater which seems to have a crescent moon. And when you do the duplication, it puts a moon as a twin moon, like Mars, of course, has two moons. So we made that connection right off. But if you look at the shape of the bed of the crater, it makes like a waning and a waxing moon. Do you see that in image H?
Image H, that's right, yep.
Right, and it's like, so this is all repetitive. I mean, not only are we finding the D&M has all this imagery that deals with the moon goddess, and then, of course, the dog, which, you know, howls at the moon, and we mention this all, the symbolism in the book about the Mesoamerican connection with the wolf and the moon goddess. Now, the old moon goddess, she's got her arms outstretched, and she has this long dress. And right out of one of the Maya codex, there's an image of the old moon goddess with her breast hanging out and her long skirt, and her arms are stretched out like the Leonardo da Vinci's anatomical man.
That's really interesting. I just wanted to ask, by the way, do you know what D&M actually stands for?
Yeah, it was L&R. Yeah.
Go, Bill.
Go ahead.
DiPietro and Molinaro, they were the first ones to discover the pyramid when they were going through the NASA archives back in the, I guess, the late 70s, early 80s. They had got permission from NASA to go through the files. They were looking for the lost, elusive image of the face on Mars. Going back to the face on Mars, they took the one image and then NASA had a press conference in 1976 saying they found this odd thing that looked like a head. And but they took another picture 3 hours later and it was just a trick of light and shadow. So DiPietro and Molinare were looking for that second image, which was never released initially to the public, and they found out that was actually taken a month or so later, so it couldn't have been taken 3 hours later. And while going through all the files and everything, they stumbled on this image that they thought looked like a five-sided pyramid. And because it was in their initial report, over the years everybody calls it the D&M pyramid.
I see. And how about the dog? Could that be another... we hear a lot about the Sirian mystery, so to speak, the connection to the dog star, obviously, in Sirius and so forth. Could that be another correlation here as well, with considering all the dog symbolism in these images?
Right. Well, even the Egyptians, you know, the dog of the underworld. So a lot of cross-cultural references, you know, to dogs in the moon. I mean, American Indians with the dogs in the moon. So, again, that all crosses cultures. But not only did we find all of this imagery related to the moon on the D&M pyramid. After the book came out, we just discovered this recently because, you know, Bill and I have been looking at this stuff for over 10 years. And sometimes, you know, you go cross-eyed, you don't know what you're looking at. And we just totally overlooked the rabbit at the peak of the D&M pyramid. I mean, even if you go back to the image here labeled D and you look at the overall shape of the D&M pyramid, it's almost like an arrowhead, and it's got a peak at the top. And right on the left, there's the profiled head of you can see the rabbit with the little whiskers. He's a very scary, evil-looking rabbit. And he's got his ears go up, because he's large ears. So it's basically a rabbit profile. And again, that was the moon goddess. Had a relationship with the rabbit, which there's a lot of Mesoamerican sculptures with little moon goddess with the rabbit sitting on her lap. So, again, the rabbit has a direct relationship with the moon goddess. She had an affair with Rabbit One.
And that could be even a reference to fertility, I guess, as well.
It's all intertwined. Again, yeah, the rabbit with fertility, exactly, connected to the moon. So this whole structure is giving us all this information about moon mythology.
And is this a reference to Earth's moon then, guys? Because that might be a little bit weird, so to speak, that a structure on Mars is referencing the moon of the Earth, right? Or what is the connection there? Is it meant for us to view it as our moon, as a kind of a symbol that the relationship, rather, between Mars and Earth, maybe? Or is there something more to that?
Well, I think it is all related to Earth. Everything that we have come across so far is directly related to Earth. I mean, the animals, it would be hard to imagine the same animals evolving exactly on another planet. So when we have pictographs of, as we show in our first book, of jaguars and turtles and fish and dolphins and rabbits and whatnot. These are all terrestrial animals, so I think it's all definitely a direct relation to the Earth.
There was one image coming out of, I think it was from one of the exploration rovers who released an image that also actually looked like a bunny sticking out of the ground almost. And I don't know if you guys have been looking at some of the more close features, so to speak, that has been found on Mars, or do you guys solely look on these satellite and probe images, so to speak, that is this from above and looking down?
I remember somebody pointing out, and I don't remember who it was, pointing out a picture from one of the rovers that looked like it could have been a bunny. They said it looked more like a rodent head or a snake head or something, and then picture that was taken shortly afterward, it didn't seem to be there anymore. So this person had surmised that it was coming, poking its head up out of the ground and then disappeared again.
Do you think that's true?
It's hard, you know, really hard to say. We really don't have enough information to know whether there's actually animal life on the surface or underground or whatnot. I don't think we have enough information yet.
And how come, George, that NASA scientists are not, like, reporting on seeing some of these features on the surface of Mars? Are they simply hiding it, you think, or is there anything else going on there?
Well, all the images that we talk about and have in the book and we're discussing right now, they're all readily available on the NASA websites. They're not really hiding anything. The only thing they're doing is not discussing it. There's no analysis going on of these anomalous formations. Publicly, they're just looking for water and evidence of past water and was there life. And, you know, if even when the little rover, you mentioned the Spirit and the Opportunity, they're driving around, if they see an anomalous rock, I mean, they do the panoramic view and you can go and look at some of the features yourself and say, oh, I'd like to go look at that thing over there. That doesn't look like a natural rock. They don't drive the rovers over there. They drive the rovers over to things that look like rocks. If something looks like a rock, they go right for it. If it doesn't, they stay away from it.
Why would NASA want to hide the discovery of artificial structures on Mars?
Well, there's a number of reasons a person could come up with, but Richard Hoagland talks about the Brookings Institute, and back in the 50s they had a group of intellectuals come together to discuss with the space program starting that what would occur should they discover evidence of extraterrestrial artifacts or intelligence. And what the conclusion they came up with was it should not be released to the public. It should be kept quiet for the reasons that it could have disastrous effects on society, which I think anybody with in this day and age with a little bit of sense, would common sense, would kind of disregard that theory. However, there are a number of conspiracy theories that there is a base, that NASA has a base on Mars already, and they have had for a long period of time, that they are perhaps in direct communication with the Anunnaki, and they are just controlling things from their standpoint and releasing a little bit of information at a time as they feel that as they feel is necessary.
George, anything to add to that?
Well, it's a real hot potato, and NASA, I think, and the government, they know the psyche of the citizens, and most people don't even think about this kind of thing. And, you know, we've already spent, over an hour and a half now talking about just these few images. And it is kind of complex, and I don't know how they would introduce this to the public, in a soundbite on the CNN News or Fox News. I mean, everything is done very quickly, on to the next story. And this would be something that you would have to really have diagrams and pictures and discussions, and then other cultures would say, well, why is it the Maya? Why is it the Mesoamerican culture? How come it's not Egyptian? How come it's not we're the Italian people. We think it should be. Why wasn't this advanced culture related to us?
Yeah.
So just this whole Mesoamerican connection, it causes problems. Because people have, like they did with the face on Mars originally, preconceived ideas. Most people think find ruins on another planet, they're going to look like something from the Greek or Roman Empire. You know what I'm saying? That's the vision they have of ruins on another planet. Nobody thinks we're going to find bifurcated mask and complex composite imagery and all this. All this stuff is very ominous too. It's very scary, and there's a lot of evil imagery that we're finding. And I don't think the public want to look at that.
What do you mean with the evil imagery? Explain that a little bit more.
Bill?
I guess relating, it depends on your point of view, but the Maya and the Olmec culture seem to be obsessed with things like weird jaguars and
death and resurrection.
Death and resurrection and demons and the lords of the underworld were the demons, and there's a lot of very kind of what you might call savage imagery involved in their culture and in what we're finding on Mars too. There's one structure that we cover in our first book, the Cydonia Codex, that was originally called the Fort from the Viking orbiter images. And it turns out that it's actually another bifurcated mask showing a couple of very grotesque images that relate to, if I can remember correctly, Georgia,
the sleeping god?
Yes, and one wears, doesn't one wear a cloak of skin from somebody?
Mm. Right, all the flayed god. And things like that. We even found that in the new book here where we talk about the a structure called the Key, which is all, we're finding all these images that are from the underworld.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was also, that's just also obviously something that Maya were fascinated with in general. I think they called it Xibalba or Kibalba. I don't know if I pronounced
it. Xibalba, yes.
Yes.
Xibalba, exactly. That's where they would the reason they would put half of the figurine into the tomb was to take that down into Xibalba.
And but again, I mean, death and resurrection is that's a Christian theme as well. And as you pointed out, George, the imagery that is that we've been talking about here is from mythology that can be found all over the world, pretty much. So in one way, I understand where you're coming from. But at the same time, if we look at it from the mainstream media, or if you look at it from the point of view of NASA or how they would release this, mm-hmm. I would think that it's very much a collaborative mythology that we've been seeing here,
right,
if you know how to interpret the symbols, of course.
Right, but I guess the whole thing about the Defense Department and the public relations with other countries and other religions with this stuff coming out and how people would monopolize, their point of view with this release of this type of information, how would the Muslim community react to something like this? This may be seen as blasphemy, that, you know, the United States government's making this all up.
It's interesting.
This opens up a whole can of worms, and, you know, a lot of the world problems are all based with religion, and this just flies in the face of a lot of that.
Right, that's right. Bill?
Yeah, I find it interesting, talking about other cultures, that what we did find was the humanoid side of the face on Mars, as we mentioned, it's a bifurcated face. When the humanoid side is duplicated, we found it represented the Mesoamerican version of First Lord, which equates with Venus. And Venus, of course, was the morning star and the evening star, and was sort of the representation of death and resurrection for the Maya. Now, if that humanoid side is inverted, we found that it presents a series of images stacked one on top of the other, which shows the helical rising of Sirius and the Egyptian gods of Isis, Ra, the sun god, and Horus, the sacred falcon, the vault of the sky and Sirius the dog star above it. And now this is would be the resurrection, the rising of Sirius the dog star above the horizon, just after prior to the sun rising. So, George mentioned about the Muslims. It's, you know, Egypt being a Muslim country, and here before, Islam religion was created, here is an Egyptian religious, which is the Egyptian religion before Islam came along.
Yeah, that's right. And George, what do you think NASA will find when they finally go to Mars? Anything specific? Do you think that they will go in this direction and look for artifacts and so forth, or will we see the continuing secrecy around some of the discoveries here?
Well, the way the NASA program is progressing, the sad news is I don't think we will be going to Mars in our lifetime. If the early explorers used the model that NASA uses about exploration, they would have never left Europe. We sent up a few shuttles and we have a few crashes, and then NASA shuts down for 5 years before they put up another shuttle. Hmm. You know, everybody's stunned that we had an accident. That would be like, you know, Columbus going out and they one of the boats sink and they all come back and say, we have to rethink this. Boats sink out in the ocean. What do we do now? It's, you know, how can we get to Mars when you have this type of thought about exploration? You know, we have to have risk. That's the only way you're going to, you know, get out into the space age. You know, we haven't even returned to the moon. I mean, they're still debating that.
Well,
so,
exactly. Those.
I don't know how we're going to get there.
That was one of my points here as well, that NASA haven't been back there for almost, you know, 40 years or something like that. And the question is what is happening. I know that they're bringing in a new shuttle. I don't know if we should call it a system or not, but they've dubbed it the Orion, which is supposed to take over from the old shuttles now that seems to be kind of outdated. And they seem to be going through a reformation of sorts, NASA, and new money seems to be coming in. But do you think they won't continue with this now, considering, I guess, the economic situation across the planet, or do you think that there will be a revival, so to speak, in space exploration in the next coming years here?
I don't know. And from what, you know, I'm sure you had Richard Hoagland on with his all of his disclosure about the NASA projects and the dark mission and the existence of, you know, structures on the moon and on Mars. I just don't see that publicly they would want to go there. I mean, how are they going to hide all this stuff?
Yeah. We had Mike Barra with us, by the way, talked about the dark mission. But Bill, did you have anything to add to that?
I was just curious. I just happened to notice when I was waiting for the call a little while ago on this one website that there was a headline says that we may be able to go to Mars sooner and in a shorter time because they're working on an ion propulsion system. Both the Canadian Space Agency and the U.S. Space Agency are working on this ion propulsion engine that could make a trip to Mars in 39 days. That's interesting.
That's very quick then, obviously. And, I mean, again, there's talks
also
about...
Also an interesting number.
Yeah, oh, right.
That's right, of course. And, you know, there is talk about potential, you know, underground bases and underground structures on Mars and so forth. We have had several people on this program to talk about this. We have these kinds of almost pipe-like formations that have been showing up on some of the images or look like tunnels or something like that. Have you guys looked at that as well?
Are you referring to the glass tubes?
Yes, something like that, yes.
Those are certainly anomalous.
Yeah, we've seen them. I can't say that we've studied them. George and I, our interest is more in the art that we have found and further researching that and its connection. And it's funny because somebody will approach George or I and say that they have found something interesting, and then when we go take a look at the strip, the image strip, we see a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
So we're thinking that there's a good part of Mars that has been altered, and if they don't want us to know, I guess they'll keep trying to hide it, but it's going to get harder and harder.
Tell us a little bit more about the book and some of the other material that you guys bring up in the new book. It has about around 14 chapters in total, and you guys primarily go into the Mayan connection with the glyphs, or are there any other chapters or points here that we haven't talked about?
The new book, basically in the beginning, it gives a little synopsis of, you know, bringing the reader up to speed with the last 30 years or so of the images of the face on Mars. And we kind of recap some of the stuff that we did in the first book. But everything that we're talking about in the new book in the 14 chapters, they're all structures that have a direct correlation with the cultures of Mesoamerica. I think Bill and I, our favorite chapter is probably chapter 11, which is the mountain of sustenance and the retrieval of the maize and chocolate. Wouldn't you agree, Bill?
Yeah, certainly. That is it's hard to pick one. The key is fascinating, as is the DNA pyramid.
Tell us about you mentioned, was that the high rise and the maize as well? Because that, as far as I know, is Templar image with the corn cob, so to speak. That's one that's been even found in Roslyn Chapel, which seems to suggest a connection between the Templars going over to America and all that. Is that the corn you're talking about, or is it something else?
Yeah, it's right. Well, the corn, remember we talked about the face on Mars? If you go back to the first image, the high rise, when the face is duplicated on the humanoid side, you have that tri-leaf symbol on the forehead. That's actually a symbol of corn. That's a corn sprout.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm.
So that's a symbol of royalty. And that was, you know, right out of the Olmec culture that the Maya also adopted, and so did the Aztec. And this whole chapter about the mountain of sustenance, this goes again back to the creation mythology, that there was this original mountain that had corn and chocolate. And you had to go into the underworld to retrieve these sacred foods. And a friend of mine, not really a friend, just someone I had met on the internet, his name was Nathan. And he had a website which is no longer in existence. And he had found this half image of a face. And over the years, it's been called, the image was called Nathan's Human Face. And it's in the book in chapter 11. And he looks very Asian. He's got the eyes, a broad nose, looks like he has a little mustache, and he's wearing what appears to be like this tri-folded hat, kind of like the American Revolutionaries wore. And we had been looking at that for years, and then NASA had taken another image of that strip, that formation, and captured actually the whole formation. And Bill and I did our duplication. It's basically a formation that's split right in half. And this whole image, in a pictographic manner, shows the whole Maya history about the retrieval of corn and maize, or corn and chocolate from the underworld. It's actually the head of Nathan's human face is actually he's a rider. He's actually riding on a jaguar.
Wow.
So then your first thought would be, well, why would he be riding on a jaguar? That's what we didn't understand that either.
Mm.
And I was going through some websites and doing some, you know, trying to find any type of connection with this idea of riding a jaguar. And, of course, I found this old Olmec image of a shaman, a little dwarf-type guy sitting on the back of a jaguar. So I said, okay, well, we got a guy here riding a jaguar. And I also found in the De Young Museum in San Francisco in California, they have this incense burner, this vessel that has a Maya shaman riding on the head of a jaguar, which looks just like Nathan's human head that we have here. And below him is this little rider that's holding on to the ears of a jaguar. So we find that this whole imagery, what these two figures are actually talking about, or they're showing in this artwork, is that this is the shaman's ride to the underworld on the jaguar. There was the nighttime jaguar that would go down into the underworld. So the shaman would ride on the back of the jaguar into the underworld to retrieve the sacred food of the gods, which was the chocolate and the corn.
How about that?
Above Nathan's head here, if you look at the book, those viewers that go out and get this book, you can see around the head of Nathan's human face are these huge pods that look like corn or chocolate pods.
How about that?
Cacao pods, yeah.
Really interesting. And if we talk a little bit about, I guess, the evidence for the material that we've been discussing here today, ultimately, is this something that can be confirmed once NASA or another agency decides to go to Mars? Or is there any other studies that can be done remotely? Let's say that by utilizing more of the rovers that go to a specific area that do tests, or is there any kind of thermal or otherwise photography, satellite photography that can be done to confirm that these are indeed artificial structures?
Well, I think personally, I think that statistically, the work that George and I have put together, this could not happen by chance, a random chance.
We have two books full of these things.
Yeah, I mean, the amount of material that we have put together is just, it's just impossible that it could have happened by chance. As far as the, you know, I'm sure that there is, NASA could, if they wanted to, they could show something that would indicate that these are artificial from all the rovers and whatever that they have. But I don't think we're going to get it in the near future. Can I just add another comment that when you were talking about the corn being a Masonic symbol, we also have a chapter 13, the bee god. The bee is another Masonic symbol, and it's also a symbol of royalty in both Egypt and Mesoamerica.
Yes.
It's,
so we're finding a lot of this overlapping archetypes.
We found a number of Masonic symbols. The owl we found as well.
There you go. And of course, these are symbols that I believe Masonry has picked up on and borrowed from more ancient cultures, because, again, these are from the mythological record of many of the civilizations across the planet, as it were. So it might not be a direct correlation to that they are Masonic, that they actually are more pointing to the fact that they reference more ancient cultures here on Earth. Don't know if you guys want to comment on that.
Yes.
George, anything to add to that?
Like we said earlier, we're finding this parallel between the cultures. On the surface, when people look at, let's say, the Egyptian mythology, Roman mythology, Greek mythology, American Indian or Mesoamerican or Hittite,
Even Vikings, since we're talking to Sweden.
Yeah, that's right, exactly. I thought about the Nordic lore about the almost a Santa Claus type figure who's riding on a wolf when you talk about the jaguar or the dog even going down into the underworld,
right.
You know, so there's multiple. Well,
the Vikings also did ornamental carvings on their teeth, just like in Mesoamerica.
Hmm.
And in our first book, I mean, right on the cover, we have a picture of what most people think looks like a Viking, which we think is actually quinticultural, the feathered serpent. And we have an Aztec image from one of the codex, which looks just like the Viking that we found on Mars. He's got the chin guard. He has the Viking image that we found on Mars has these long braids, kind of like Willie Nelson would have. And we noticed there's these odd little heads at the end of the braid at the bottom. It's like little serpent heads. And the same comparison we're making with this Aztec image of Quetzalcoatl, the feathered serpent, he has these ear spools with these serpents coming down. And he has this chin guard, and he has a helmet. And basically, if you didn't know any better, you'd think he was a Viking warrior.
Well, I mean, it is curious, considering that NASA named one of those first explorers the Viking, and that that took those images in the beginning, and that might be, I don't know, a symbolic reference to the fact that the Vikings...
And how many Vikings were there?
Viking
1 and the Viking 2, they were twins.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
The twinning.
There you go.
Right from the beginning, the whole idea of twins.
And again, the twin idea is also in Roman lore. For instance, we have the Romulus and Remus, the two twins who's feeding off the wolf or the dog, the milk of the dog.
Exactly.
So that's really interesting that you guys have studied this from a mythological perspective, because again, that makes a very interesting clear connection between Earth and Mars. And if we just talk a little, if we go off into some other tangents here for a little while and just briefly talk about, I guess, the people who might be responsible for at least bringing these symbolic symbols to us from the beginning, do any of you guys believe that they are, still around and watching things around here and potentially even over our progress of how we discover these symbols, considering the potential fact that these are images to us, or that it's up to us to find this, so to speak. And at that point, if we do that, we might end up in a situation where we actually are contacted in one way or another. Any comments on that?
Well, my personal opinion is that they're still around. If you put together Zachariah Sitchin's work and his interpretation that we were created by the Anunnaki, humans were created to work for the Anunnaki, work for the gods, and then the biblical story of God creating us. Well, the gods creating us is what Sitchin says. So if we were created by the Anunnaki to toil for them, be their servants, whatever, I think that they wouldn't have left. Possibly they you know, they are based on Mars or they are based on Earth. I think that they are still here. There's definitely a connection with NASA and Masonic symbolisms, Masonic numbers, and whatnot. What bothers me is they had extremely advanced technology thousands of years ago, and they have not passed it along to us. They have not brought us along. They have kept us very earthbound.
Yes, that's right. But in closing, or as we begin to round things up here for the second hour, does anyone want to talk a little bit about Project Teardrop? Maybe I found a link about this from your website.
Oh yes, Project Teardrop was inspired from what Bill and I were originally doing with the Sedonia area, and we had the Sedonia Institute, and which basically was just dedicated to figuring out what was going on in the Sedonia area with the face on Mars and the D&M pyramid and the fort and the little cluster of structures that Hoagland called the city. And while we were doing all that research, we were finding some strange anomalies outside of Sedonia. And so that was just an offshoot of the Sedonia Institute, which was dedicated to looking at other features outside of the Sedonia area. And the reason it was called Project Teardrop, I think I mentioned it on the site over there, was inspired by what one of the NASA employees said about looking at some of the pictures that they got back from the Mars Global Surveyor, how you know, he actually was crying. They were so beautiful. And that's the whole idea of the ancient mythology from the Peruvian cultures, where the tears of the gods were like gold that would stream down their face. So, and basically, I just figured we'd call it Project Teardrop. And one of the first things we were looking at was a teardrop face or teardrop shaped anomaly that was actually in the book that Randolfo Puzo had put out, and that was one of the first projects that we started to try to do an analysis of, this teardrop-shaped formation that, again, seemed to have these bifurcated aspects to it, different face on each side. So that's basically the short story of how the Project Teardrop started.
Excellent. And, again, the website is thesedoniainstitute.com. Maybe you want to mention again the titles again and how our listeners can get copies if they want to read more of the material that you've been working on.
Well, they can go to the website. We have a section on the website that's dedicated to the book. They can also order the book directly from us here at the Sedonia Institute, which is, this address is also on the internet, the website. It's P.O. Box 102, Percival, Virginia. That's in the United States. And that area code is 20132. And those customers or listeners that are in the area of Sweden, if they'd send us a letter, we can figure out how much it would cost to send them out a book.
Excellent. Thank you both again very much for coming on the program. I really enjoyed it, and it's been really interesting. Bill, thank you very much for your time and for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Same to you, George. A pleasure having you both on.
I enjoyed it. It's been a lot of fun, and maybe if we get some more information about some of these other structures that Bill and I are working on behind the scenes, we'll give you a call, and maybe you can take a look at those.
Thank you for joining us. We have much more good stuff for you in the pipeline. Footage from Ireland covering the Lisbon Treaty vote. We have an upcoming webcast and a video interview beyond the radio shows that we provide for you each week. My thanks to Fredrik and Elizabeth. My name is Henrik. We will talk more soon. Bye-bye.